You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Donald Cuspid. Donald, thanks so much for being with me today.
My pleasure.
To begin with, I want to discuss your projects and what you're working on now, and I know that there are several things. So can you tell me a little bit about what you're involved with at the moment in terms of projects?
Yes, I'm about to publish a collection of my poems. It's a particular collection called In Homage to Death, and it will be published together with photographs by a photographer named Lynn Stern. It's a series of skulls that she did over about 25 years. They're very beautiful works. She's fairly prominent photographer. Her work is in the collection of the Archives of Creative Photography at Tucson, Arizona. So that's one project. The other thing is I've done a recent project, just finished actually, an essay on German realism between the Great Wars, that is during the Weimar Republic. It's partly coordinated with an exhibition at the Neue Gallery dealing with the same theme, Neue Gallery in New York dealing with the same theme. And it's called The Bitter Truth, and it deals with the art that's going on there. Those are two main projects now.
And I'd like to talk about criticism and your role in it in history, but I'd like to start off with some of your poems. Would you mind reading us perhaps a poem or two from the recent series that you just mentioned?
All right, if you're ready to bear it. I'll read you the first poem in Homage to Death. This is Homage to Death 1. No regrets, life on fast forward to the infinite, the flesh abiding in finite memory, time at last at a loss. No more burdens of whimsy, no more probing of possibility, no more mistakes of misery. The final silence is fluid with myth, fertile with the final intimacy, innocence renewed, cocooned in the unconscious, fastened to a dead leaf. My shadow is stale in the dawn. How about that?
Well, I like that. I mean, you know, in one way, I always find even the darkest of poems, it's life affirming. It's an homage to death, but it's also a meditation on what life is. You know,
I'll read you one more, which is directly related to Lynn Stern's images of skulls, which are basically abstract. She treats the skull as an abstract object, lights it up rather beautifully, light and dark shadow, stages it. Uses combinations of animal skulls and human skulls. It's quite an extraordinary series. Part of it has already been seen in Spain, and hopefully the rest will be seen here. So this is the second one, and it's in relation to her skull photography. Excuse me. Bright with shadow, the skull lights every inch of the emptiness. Incarnate in hollow bone, truth accompanies the meanderings of my wonder. Facing me at every twist of thought, its grimace nearer to me than my own face, laming my smile with glistening silence. Lead the way to the world beyond words, peel the rust of memory away, strip me to the bitter bone of being, unlock the silence and stone. Your indifference is the thoughtfulness of the cosmos, wisdom of forgetfulness.
Beautiful poem. Is there, you said you were also working on love poems. Would you mind reading us one of those?
Oh, okay. Here we go. This is just called Eros and Thanatos, for me, is what it's about. This is Eros, and it's addressed to a person, say a beloved. Let us imagine that we're unimaginable, mirages meeting in myth, uplifted by enigma into the night sky of memory. Then our love will be boundless because fleshless. Then we will be constellations as luminous as gods. No longer in need of fate to meet, we will last as long as they do. We will forget the fickleness of feeling. We will no longer need theories to rationalize our trust. Our senses will speak the truth of our togetherness, even when our bodies are separate. Intimacy will suspend death when our love is consummated in our unconscious. How about that?
Yeah, lovely, lovely poem.
Thank you.
And since you have it there, if I can ask you to read one more, the last one, before we continue the interview, since you have the love poems out.
Absolutely. Again and again, we sighting each other beyond the dread, the distance incalculable, bridged by our being. Together again and again until there are no more agains, only the constant gain of our closeness and truth, privileged by the gods and goddesses of forgiving love, intimacy the only lasting, time and space apart, overcome by touch of thought and feeling, futility forgotten in the forever of our moment, ours alone, the folly of the world, unable to enter our garden of gratitude. You give me again, I give you again, we giving together again and again, eternal return of the enigma of our love, we never apart, whatever stands between us, we thriving in the depths of feeling, the luminous pearl in its darkness showing us our way, intense light, the gift entrusted to us by the unseen powers and the silence emanating from our memories.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
To talk a little bit about the series of poems that are about to be released, The Homage to Death, it's something that you don't often see much in the art world, and of course this is the world of poetry, but aging in the art world and death is a difficult subject that we don't hear much about. Do you agree? Or
yes, I agree completely. I think the art world is focused on so-called quote emerging artists, that are artists who suddenly appear, seem to do some interesting work, and then they tend to be forgotten, with certain exceptions, and it's not always clear why certain artists are more remembered, why they continue to have careers, why they're celebrated into old age. I remember a few years ago in New York, there was an exhibition of, quote, older artists. They had been known before, but it was like a novelty to be an older artist, as it were, and to continue to make creative work. So our society is very youth-focused, as you probably know, and I think the whole idea that used to be around that, after you're 30, you're obsolete. Well, people who are younger than 30 don't realize that they're lucky if they got beyond 30, and they're even luckier if they get to my age. I'm 80 years old, so I'm preoccupied with death as well as with life. I've written about, interesting you mentioned about dealing with death in art. I wrote a series of articles for American Art Quarterly dealing with so-called noble death, an idea in Aristotle traced to Marcus Aurelius, and I went through the history of art and got images, sculptures, whatever, showing noble death. And you get to the modern period, no noble death. All death is ignoble. All death is dreadful. Classic example is the prints by Otto Dix dealing with the death that happened in World War I in which he served. So yes, but the art world is focused on young people, and I think it partly has to do with the market. Somebody's emerging, the prices are less expensive than they might be, and then if it works out well, that the person gets a reputation or publicity or whatever, the work goes up in value, and then it will sustain itself. Also, there's a certain narrow reading of art history, I think, things in, let's say, in so-called avant-garde tradition is regarded as continuously valuable, important. It's kind of an inertial system in the art world. And then every once in a while you see some other kind of work emerging. And a good example of that for me is what's currently going on in the Whitney Museum, where you have Frank Stella, marvelous retrospective, really a selection of works, very prominent artist who's now 79. And it's all modernist, I would say late avant-garde, what I call endgame modernism. And then you have a marvelous discovery of an African-American artist, Harlem Renaissance artist, absolutely beautiful representational work. And it's given a certain importance, but it's not given the pride of place that Stella's given, because he represents this tradition, which is basically avant-garde tradition. And his work is a sort of riff, in my opinion, the sculpture on Picasso. If you compare some of the sculptures in the Picasso exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art, you'll see that. So Frank Stella has survived into his 80s, but this artist, his name was Archibald, I believe, he has sort of reemerged now because it's, quote, let's say, important to show African-American artists, but he's representational artists, which is why he didn't get the full attention that he should have gotten when he was working, which is in the 30s into the 40s, and the work is quite brilliant, et cetera. So what I'm saying is that there's a retrospective look, but at the time that he was making it, he was not fashionable. So no matter how old or young he was, But also one other thing, going back to the death theme, I think, you know, Jessica Mitford's American Way of Life sort of summarizes the whole difficulty with dealing with death as a subject matter. You may recall also, I believe it was during one of our many wars, it was forbidden to photograph coffins draped with American flag of containing bodies of soldiers who died in battle. I think this was an episode that happened in Dover, Maryland Air Force Base, and the government forbid it, but some photographer happily got in, and this was published in the media, and everybody was excited. Nobody wants to pay attention to death. Nobody wants to pay attention to old age. It's all, you know, new, keep making it new. And also, that's another important thing, there's really very little sense of history going on in this society. So as long as it's new, it's young, it's emerging, that's all that matters. It's, you know, what they call the shock of the new in art and maybe in society. Always keeping it new, and you don't want to get old, but I think one's fortunate if one gets old. But anyway, that's it.
I think so, too, and I mean, also in continuing to talk about that theme, you know, sometimes it's also you see it coming from a younger artist or a younger poet, you know, from a very different vantage point. But I remember when I was quite young in college, writing, you know, short artist books about you know, my mother approaching the age of death, or that people are dying. But it was written from the vantage point of a young person. And though you're writing this now, weren't you also writing poems about death at a younger age, though from a very different vantage point? We begin feeling our mortality and getting very often dramatic in college years or thereabouts.
Yes, I had an awareness of it, partly tied into depressive situations, but I was tended to, I was sort of a romantic poet as it began. I was published in Quarterly Review of Literature. I was at Yale as a graduate student, as Columbia's undergraduate. I was known, did some poetry, but I tended to be sort of romantic, and I was very interested in nature and landscape. But there was a kind of death there. The first book of poems, which I sort of juvenilia, was called Dirge for a Toy Centurion. So there was the death theme, the lament. And I think it was connected up with a kind of a depressive tendency that I had. So if you're aware of, shall we say, the bad feelings or the negative feelings, the dead feelings, the feelings that are fatal to your ego that seem to undermine you, one is dealing with death directly or indirectly, even when one's young. But tell me something about yourself. You're a poet and a writer when you're young. How old are you?
When I was I'm 50 now, and when I was in SUNY Purchase and in college, I remember working with different people. At the time, it was Antonio Frasconi and others making artist books.
Yes.
But at the time, it struck me that I remember I was talking about, you know, it's my mother's 54, and she talks about her friends who are dying, and you know, laughs, but it's not very funny. And began, you know, even though then, now that seems incredibly young to me. And, you know, my mother was entertained by that. At the time, it was just this kind of young awareness of people are dying. I will die eventually. And perhaps because I was in college, having the luxury to almost ruminate on that more than perhaps I should have.
Yeah, I understand. I understand the feeling. Of course, one is always close to one's mother and sensitive to that. But, you know, when you look back at the history of art, broadly speaking, some of the greatest work deal with it. To me, one of the great masterpieces of all time is Holbein's Ambassador with that anamorphic skull, you know, and then you stand in the right position and boom, it becomes a skull instead of some abstract blur, blob. And if you go back through a lot of religious art, the theme is there in a variety of ways. You can't escape it. But when we move into the modern world, it's all going to be fresh and new, and death becomes less trenchant. Although I've noticed some interesting thing going on. I've seen artists dealing with skulls. Donald Bachelar did some rather comic skulls, for example, humors. So it's sort of there. And I'm struck by the fact that I see on the streets of New York, and I'm sure you see it in New Haven, wherever, young people with T-shirts with skulls on it, maybe a pirate signal, but also death signal. I've seen shoelaces with skulls on it. I've done sort of a little bit of research in this kitchen for the publication with Lynn Stern. I did an essay dealing with the imagery of skulls and hers in comparison right through the history of art from the beginning. And it's quite interesting. Took it up to the kitschification of the skull now. And I suppose it's a defense or, I don't know, a novelty or whatever you want to call it, or a novel defense. But there is this awareness creeping in. And I think in our society, however much it's focused on youth, you can't help but be aware of death. We're a society in perpetual war. We've got all these wars in the Mideast. We're involved. We have all the deaths occurring. Also, we had this whole surge of deaths because of AIDS. So it's there, and however much you want to deny it, it's there, and it will creep into consciousness and then maybe handled in a, quote, kitschy or comic way as a way of defending against it, as it were.
Well, and it seems that sometimes there can be, you know, surprises in you know, later in life. I was talking to Dwayne Michaels, who I interviewed quite a while ago, the photographer, and here he is, 82 years old, taking care of his partner, you know, with Alzheimer's, and, you know, for the first time in his life, or so it seems, he's working with video, and although he's, you know, one of the more, one of the artists whose work has almost continually focused on death since he was very young, now it means something different to him, but he's also working with video, and as though the work is still very much about death, he has a tremendous sense of life to him. Perhaps because of that, it's sort of confusing to me.
Well, I think, you know, in a way, it's the issue that Freud in his last formulation set up between Eros and Thanatos. And in the example he gave, Thanatos is very speculative as it's regarded death instinct, that we are biologically have death built into us, and there is a tendency to death, death being sort of the lack, the end of all stimulation, all excitement, etc. And Eros, but his example of Eros and Thanatos is conveyed in metaphor he uses, which is very interesting. He doesn't deal with sexuality. Sex is just one mode of relationship for him, but he takes an army, and he says, when the soldiers are all holding together on the battlefield, and there's sort of this brotherhood, as it's called, and they're all united, that's Eros, that's libido, that's holding them together, okay? That is a binding force. Eros is a binding force on whatever level it binds. Friendship, sex, even just polite relationships, it's a binding force. And then one moment, one soldier sort of gets anxious, you know, as the enemy comes, breaks ranks, and the whole thing disintegrates, and that's Thanatos. So Thanatos is fragmentation, disintegration, etc. And I think we oscillate back and forth between them. I think that's always there. And it's been argued, I'm very much a subscriber to certain psychoanalytic thinkers. I've studied psychoanalysis, had 4 years of didactic training in it, and I'm taken with Melanie Klein's attention to the death instinct, the distinction she makes between the paranoid schizoid position, the splitting, the keeping all good things for oneself, expelling all the bad things, the deadly things, as it were, the bad feelings, and then finally the integration of them in the depressive position, integration of love and hate, the achievement of ambivalence. Analysts speak of the need for capacity of ambivalence. We're all ambivalence, and that's the oscillation between life and death. So if you focus on death, so to say, if you tilt that way, the pendulum, so to say, will just of its own momentum go towards the life. But there's no doubt that some people get totally, so to say, caught up in destructiveness, self-destructiveness, etc. There's no question about that. So I would say that would explain what Michael's, but he wants to hold on to life. He wants to, you know, sustain the life of the man he's been with. He wants to love. He wants to love. And I think you can't do full love without acknowledgement of the reality of death or the hatefulness of death or whatever you want to call it. When you look at the German treatment of the triumph of death, for example, in Hans Baldwin Grün, who's one of the great masters of this, what you see often, and Holbein does this also, you see often a very beautiful young girl death, a skeletal male figure, sort of molding corpse, sort of coming after her. But there's her beauty is front and center, and she represents life. Now, there's also, you know, an issue at that time, you know, before modern medicine, people were dying fairly young. I was struck, I was in the Metropolitan Museum, and I went to see this Egypt Transformed exhibition, and I was struck with how obsessed with death the pharaohs were, and all these things they were concerned about. There were apparently special gods to help during pregnancy of a woman, during birth, because many children died, and the woman could die in childbirth and so forth. And all of their gods, it struck me, a great deal of them, had to do with countering the awareness of death, which was there, by ideas of fertility, life, etc. And I did some research, and the life expectancy in Egypt at that time was 35, which seems, you know, very low by our standards. But as we live longer, two things, I think, happen. We tend to forget, hey, we are going to die eventually. But also, in some sense, the idea of death is put at a distance. Well, it's not going to happen now. After all, the life expectancy is now 76 or 80 or whatever. Apparently, Google is working on ideas in medicine that will make us live to 150. I've actually read that they think they're going to get rid of death, which I don't quite believe. There's a problem there. Simone de Beauvoir once wrote a novel, which I haven't read in years, but I remember it quite wonderful, about a guy who lives forever. And he's in a state of boredom. He's done everything whatsoever. He can never die in a state of boredom. It's a very interesting idea. I'm sort of rambling, but what I'm saying is, wherever, to just go back to your basic point, which I think is absolutely correct, the awareness of death will sharpen your sense of life and make you want to live more. And the awareness of life cannot help be shadowed, as it were, tinged by awareness of death. It's like the day, you know, the sun comes up, there's life, and then goes down, and sort of death is in the air at darkness. And there is this back and forth oscillation. It's been there forever in myths, and it exists in our time. But we live longer, generally speaking, and this makes an issue. You're quite right to think that, you know, in the 50s, when your mother was concerned about this, became aware of it, that seems rather young. But people were, in fact, dying then. I don't know what the life expectancy was at the time your mother was alive, but probably not as much as now. Okay. I'm saying too much.
No, that was fine. I really enjoyed talking about this and that we spent the talk on death, because it's a difficult subject and a very interesting one. In closing the interview, is there anything you want to point listeners to? They're from all over the world, and you're in New York now. Is there shows or exhibits you want to point people to, or anything before we close? There's going to be links in your interviews to some of the things we've discussed, as well as your books, but is there anything
yes.
in particular you want to point people to?
There are three major exhibitions, at least in New York. Two of them strike me as especially important. One is the Picasso Sculpture Exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art, which is quite interesting. Really a revelation in terms of, you realize all his work is on a kind of figure level, figure schedule, a scale, and it's quite extraordinary to watch his development. Beautifully laid out exhibition. And the other is the exhibition at the Neue Gallery that I mentioned, which is a marvelous survey of German art in Berlin in the Weimar Republic period, that is between the Great Wars. And what is especially significant from my point of view in this exhibition is the attention given to Hanna Hoch, who's always been known as an important collagist, but they also have her later work, her painting, and she's a great woman artist who's been very, very neglected, apart from certain work she did when she was sort of semi-officially a member of the Dadaist group. but it's an extraordinary exhibition, very, very rich. Those are two things. And then there are these individual exhibitions at the Whitney Museum. Those strike me as particularly worth the trouble. I didn't particularly care for the layout of the Stella exhibition, but it's quite interesting to see his development moving away from painting into sort of off-the-wall sculpture. That's extremely interesting. Those are some of the things I would point to. But certainly the Neue Gallery Berlin and the Picasso sculpture are major exhibitions worth seeing.
Donald, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's good to talk with you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.